This is perhaps the most unusual Remembrance Sunday since the first one in 1919 that many of us can recall. We cannot mark the occasion with our usual solemnity and ceremony and can only meet remotely to remember the war dead. But although we cannot physically be together, we can and will express our sense of communal remembrance through this and the countless other similar services across our nation. This year has marked the 75th anniversary of VE Day and VJ Day and the end of the Second World War. Once again, we saw the films of cheering crowds and street parties and great rejoicing, even if COVID prevented us from marking the anniversaries in any really meaningful way. The British people and their allies in 1945 were not just celebrating victory, but relief at the end of a time of great anxiety, as well as hope that life could return to something like normal soon. There had been almost 6 years of constant worry over the lives of loved ones, of the curtailment of many personal liberties, of shortages, of economic damage which would take years, decades from which to recover, of travel severely disrupted and restricted, of disruption to normal life. Sounds familiar? There are many parallels between wartime Britain and today's lockdown Britain, and there has been talk of trying to rekindle the wartime spirit. But I have a feeling we look back now on those days from 75 years on with rose-tinted spectacles to an extent. In reality, they were terrible years of death and destruction, of rationing and restriction, of loss and anxiety for everyone. People got through it because they had to. And how much worse was the anxiety over friends and family a generation earlier, when the mounting casualty lists were so horrific? There cannot have been many people in Britain who did not know someone who had been killed in the First World War. A few years ago, I was driving near Wells in Somerset when I came across the village of Rodney Stoke. The sign as you come into the village proclaims it as a thankful village. I discovered it was one of the handful of communities in the UK that lost none of its young men in the First World War. There are not many such villages, none at all in Cambridgeshire or in my home county of Warwickshire, for instance. And rather shockingly, only one in the whole of France, only one. Further research revealed that one of my favourite places in the Cotswolds, near where I was brought up, the rather inaptly named in this context of the village of Upper Slaughter, is one of a dozen or so doubly thankful villages who lost no one in either World War. We are used to the memorials in every parish church, on almost every village green, in every town centre, in every school and college, in factories and shops and banks and railway stations. The sheer scale of the sacrifice, particularly in the First World War, the loss of talent, the loss of loved ones, the loss of hope for the future, the heart ripped out of communities and families and institutions, endless lists of names. There are probably hardly anyone left now who remembers any of the men killed in the First World War. And survivors of the Second World War are getting frail and very elderly, if many remaining indomitable, like the famous Captain Tom. Yet in services like this, we are remembering them as people, not just as a list of names. These men and some women were alive as us, each with their personality and ambitions and relationships and histories. And great efforts are rightly being made to bring some of them to life as people research their brief lives. At Queen's College, St. Botolph's is our parish church, we have begun to try to find out something about those long dead casualties in the First World War. The numbers on our memorial are considerably greater than a year's worth of intake of students. one local man, a medical student who was killed at the front in 1915, had a sister at Girton who became a war poet. And this was her reaction to going to the theatre in Cambridge one day during the Great War. Over the footlights, the ankles caper, the grease paint glistens, the fringed eyes glance. The last note shrills and the curtain runs. The man beside me opens a paper. Bitter weather, 3 mile advance, heavy losses. We take the guns. And between my eyes and the crimson lights move the ranks of men who sat here o' nights and now lie heaped in the mud together, stiff and still in the bitter weather. This year has also been the 80th anniversary of many of the iconic events of the early days of the Second World War. Dunkirk, the Battle of Britain, the beginning of the Blitz. 80 years ago, my mother was a 19-year-old student at Birmingham University studying for a teaching diploma. On the 14th of November 1940, so the anniversary is next Saturday, at the end of the day, she commuted as usual by train and bus back to her suburban home in Coventry. She had tea with her mother and sister and settled to writing a geography essay. We still have the atlas that she was using on that evening. They heard the noise of aircraft, so my mother and grandmother went into the front room to see if they could see anything. They were just in time to see the whole row of houses opposite collapse, apparently in complete silence. They ran for the cupboard under the stairs, but the whole front window followed them, and my mother was very, very badly cut about her face and neck. And then the house disintegrated on top of them. The family and their pet cat, I'm happy to say, managed to crawl to safety out of the house. My mother's serious bleeding was staunched in a shelter, and later a car was found to take her to hospital. As she came into the city centre in Coventry, she could clearly see the cathedral, where my grandfather was church warden, with flames pouring through its windows and roof. There followed a night of terror in the hospital, with bombs raining down, anti-aircraft guns firing non-stop across the road, and more gravely injured people piling up around her. Eventually, she was evacuated to Rugby and spent many weeks in hospital as attempts were made to tend her injuries. She lived to be 93, but all her life, she had to wear heavy makeup to hide the scars, and she never really recovered good health. And I have inherited no heirlooms, not even any family photographs. Everything except the atlas and one bed was destroyed. Today I am wearing not just a poppy, but my little Coventry cross of nails. My mother's story and the ruins of Coventry Cathedral serve to remind us that war involves not just the loss of life and limb, but of health, of property, of beauty, of heritage, of goodwill. Animosities can last for generations. I once visited the small town of Waterford, Virginia, which supported the North in the American Civil War. The town and its people have been ostracized, ignored, and isolated ever since by the rest of the state. We can put the men and women commemorated on our memorials on a pedestal, heroes, the bravest of the brave. And yes, they did die heroically for our cause, in our name, for the future of our nation. But they were not supermen. They were ordinary people like us, put into a situation where they had to be heroic and self-sacrificial and give up their lives out of love. Greater love hath no man than this, that a man lay down his life for his friends. Words from St. John's Gospel we heard read earlier and inscribed on countless war memorials. In context, of course, this text is nothing to do with soldiers or war, It is about Jesus and his self-sacrifice of his life on the cross for his friends, for us, for all who follow him, to take away our guilt and sin. In the Christian tradition, therefore, self-sacrifice is seen as the epitome of love. God loved us so much that he gave us his Son to die for us in our place as the ultimate self-sacrifice. Self-sacrifice is putting others first, service. And so service is the true mark of love between couples, between friends, within families, within communities, within nations. True love involves service, giving, sacrifice of oneself in some way for the loved one. Those young men whose names appear on our war memorials went to war willing to sacrifice themselves for love of king and country, for love of the cause and the British way of life, for love of their families, for love of their pals, and of course, in a very real sense, for love of future generations. Some went to war enthusiastically or with excitement. Some went reluctantly and with great trepidation. Some went to use their skills to serve others, the doctors, the chaplains, the vets, the butchers and bakers, and the transport people. Many just went out of a sense of duty. All went, we can say, out of a sense of love, with a willingness, if need be, to be self-sacrificial. Their sacrifice was heroic, even if few of them would have considered themselves heroes. In war, people have to compel themselves to be courageous. And for those who survive, the easiest way of coping with that experience of forced courage in appalling circumstances is to wall off the memories and not speak about them. I'm old enough to have known quite a lot of men who fought in the First World War, including my grandfather, who was in the trenches in the Royal Warwickshires. Few of them would ever talk about it. The two world wars of the 20th century were a long time ago now, and we have been urged quite properly to include in our thoughts men and women who have lost their lives or have been maimed in more recent conflicts. Yet I think it is the horrific scale of the casualty lists in the two world wars, but especially the first, that strikes us today. And it is that sheer scale that impels us to continue to commemorate and to remember and to give thanks, even 75, 80, 100 years on. We also remember that the majority of those killed were not professional soldiers, but part-timers, or volunteers or conscripts from the civilian population, ordinary people. No wonder when the Great War ended, people felt it had been the war to end all wars. Who could conceive of such a slaughter on such a scale again? Who could lead a nation, any nation, into war again and risk such loss? Surely humankind could devise a means of stopping such conflicts. Sadly, we know that the First World War was just a prelude to an even more cataclysmic conflict with far greater destruction of human life and property and decency, even if the numbers of British casualties were considerably less. And wars have gone on, and man's inhumanity to man continues unabated. It is part of human nature, of course, to be selfish, self-centered, not self-sacrificial, to give priority to my good, never mind anyone else's, my nation's good, my faction's good, my ideology's good, my take on religion's good, my friends and family's good, my class's good. Putting self first, before others, before God, will always lead to conflict. The selfish gene is ineradicable. Jesus, of course, suggested a remedy. Reverse the order. God, others, self. In a few weeks' time, it will be Christmas again and time for carols. So I end with the familiar words of the carol, "It Came Upon the Midnight Clear." verse 3 reflects on the angel's message of peace on earth, goodwill towards men. Yet with the woes of sin and strife, the world has suffered long. Beneath the angel's strain have rolled 2,000 years of wrong. And man at war with man hears not the love song which they bring. Oh, hush the noise, ye men of strife, and hear the angels sing.